From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Which of us doesn't want to look out at a more resilient, manageable, and sustainable landscape? One that really works environmentally, but also aesthetically, that's not messy or chaotic. Since the book Planting in a Post-Wild World came out in 2015, co-authored by today's guest, Claudia West, and her colleague Thomas Rayner, I've been gradually studying their ideas and starting to have some light bulbs go off on how to be inspired to put plants together in the ways that nature does in layered communities. I'm pleased that Claudia is here today to talk about some of the practical, tactical aspects of plant community-inspired designs that we can apply to our own gardens. And even more exciting news, she'll be the visiting expert lecturer here at my place the morning of August 17th during my next Garden Open Day, and also give an afternoon design workshop. Details about joining us will be in just a bit later in the show. But first, let's welcome, at least virtually for the moment, Claudia West to Away to Garden. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Yes, and I'm so looking forward to your visit. And I only wish I could not greet my visitors that afternoon and come to the workshop myself.
Yes. I think we will have a lot of fun.
Yes. So I should start by saying congratulations on the new venture that you and Melissa Rayner and Thomas Rayner have recently begun called Phyto Studio. I looked at the website, and the banner on the phytostudio.com homepage speaks of crafting artistic and technical solutions for the next revolution in planting design. So that's your mission, yes?
Absolutely, and we are so excited to delve much deeper into the world of functional planting design as a team. We are extremely passionate about developing functional and ecological planting further to rebuild the foundation of life on the planet.
Just a small goal, yes, Claudia?
Just a small goal.
Just a little bit.
Inspiring.
Yeah. So to step back just a bit first, let's give us a brief bio kind of how you got from your own beginnings on Earth, as you just mentioned, to sort of doing this, and especially, you know, your grasp of native plants in the U.S., I don't think that's the landscape you began with, was it?
And that is so true. I, as you can hear from my accent, I'm from Eastern Germany, and the landscapes of my childhood were a very dark and polluted place. My hometown was surrounded by soft coal mines that put incredible amounts of pollution into the air. Some of the mining fields they left behind looked like nature would never have a chance to return. And when I go back to exactly these same craters in our landscape now, they're filled with crystal clear water, and young forests are thriving right next to these lakes. Mm. So based on that experience, I have a deeply optimistic view over what we as gardeners and landscape professionals can achieve in really a very short lifetime. I truly believe that wildness in nature is a renewable resource, and that every single plant we put in the ground can make a difference. I have to honestly say that, like many other Europeans, I've always been in love with American native plants. We use them quite frequently in European landscapes, and that curiosity and really desire to learn more about these plants brought me my first plane ticket to the United States.
Yeah.
And I was so shocked when I finally got here at age 18 to learn more about these incredible American beautiful plants that very few of them were actually used in the mainstream American landscape.
Yes,
so I think this,
it's kind of interesting because I had friends who were German, I believe they lived in Frankfurt at the time that I visited them, and I went and I, you know, when they were at work during the days, I would go around to various gardens, and I believe, and I'm going to not remember because it's a long time ago, but public gardens, there might have even been one there, and there were plantings that were in a naturalistic style, and they did include some American plants, and it was just very interesting for me, you know, that I was like, whoa, we don't use those. This was, again, decades ago.
No, it's remarkable. You will find American phlox and black-eyed sultans and purple cornflowers in every German yard.
Yeah.
To the point where you almost think they're European plants.
So something that you have said to me when we've spoken before, and your colleague Thomas Rayner has said to me in similar words, that really sticks in my head is that plants are the mulch. So let's start there at that layer, because again, the concept in planting in a post-wild world and in the lecture and workshop you're going to do, you know, it talks about this sort of layering in this community-inspired method. So if that first layer is plants are the mulch.
Yeah, and I think every gardener intuitively knows that, because we gardeners and landscape professionals were inspired by natural plant communities that we may see on a hike out in a natural area or somewhere on vacation. And very rarely do we see bare soil anywhere in natural wild ecosystems. I think one of the core principles of the natural world is that plants cover soil. And if you are in a really arid climate where you would have a lot of desertscape, bare soil landscapes. But I think that the same principle is extremely powerful in a garden setting, and it produces much, much more sustainable landscapes if we meet nature halfway and work around this concept that plants cover soil, that nature abhors a vacuum. I think that instead of mulching with wood, working with plants, like they're designed in evolutionary terms to grow on this planet, is beneficial in many, many different ways. It doesn't only look more inspiring and beautiful to create lush, dense planting that mimics how plants arrange themselves in the wild, but it also provides denser habitat for some of the beautiful wildlife we so enjoy in our gardens. And it soaks up the rain. We talk about rain gardens or sponge gardens a lot, and the more biomass we can put into our gardens, the more rain gets absorbed, put back into the ground to recharge the aquifer. So I think on many different layers, working with this natural principle is beneficial and just so fulfilling and so meaningful for gardeners and designers.
So nature doesn't go to the garden center and buy bagged mulch, is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right. And I don't know where this almost perverse tradition came from, but I'm hoping that collectively as the green industry, as gardeners, can move away from that again and steal some of this business back to put what really belongs in or on the ground back into our landscapes.
Right.
And that is thriving plants.
So that we're not displaying mulch as our design element.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even if we're using it for, you know, in the beginning when we first plant something for weed suppression and, you know, kind of mitigation of, you know, the pounding of rain or whatever, or the baking of sun, we're not planning on it being a permanent feature to show off the mulch spaces.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that temporary mulches can be incredibly helpful. They can help you suppress weeds and kickstart soil, especially after disturbance. But I think the problem starts as soon as mulch starts replacing plants, and that is problematic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's okay when the plants touch, isn't it? When they all connect, isn't it? Yeah,
I know.
Yeah, so
plants are social creatures.
So when I know plants are social creatures. I love that. When Thomas Rayner, your colleague, and I did that New York Times article not long ago, that was one of the things we talked about, and it was kind of funny and it was adorable, and I think it sticks in people's heads. It's a great way to think about it. So
exactly.
Now, when you're a landscape designer. And you are an expert in many kinds of plants, and so you get called upon to go to a prospective client's site, I assume, and you walk around with them. And so when you first go to a place that you might be hired to work at, with your expert eyes and your knowledge, what are you looking for as clues to, like, what to do there and what to plant there? Like, where do you get your cues or your clues on and your inspiration?
Yeah, so this is something that can be extremely difficult if you walk through your own property and try to see what inspires you or try to read it more carefully. Sometimes emotions get in the way, and stories, connections we have with many of the individual plants that we love so much in our garden. So sometimes it's a luxury as a designer to come on a site where you see it with very fresh eyes, and you are able to almost from a distance judge the planting, the existing conditions. So it's a privilege sometimes to be able to do that. And because of that looser emotional connections with new sites, it's often easier to see the potential and sometimes the constraints of sites when it comes to elevating them emotionally and creating deeper spaces for our clients. So unless, you know, very often when we talk to homeowners and then other clients at the beginning, sometimes it can feel incredibly overwhelming to look at the mass of plantings and see the bones of it. But it's really not that difficult a task. You can almost take it in stages, where we often start by analyzing the structural items first.
Okay.
So sometimes you have existing trees, you have shrubs, you have infrastructures, you have fences, you have buildings, you have all of these hard frames that create one layer of a planting. And they often indicate what kind of landscape archetype your site will be, wants to be, could be in the future.
Okay.
These archetypes can help create evocative planting, emotional planting, and make the whole creation much more legible. So if a site, for example, has a beautiful array of mature trees, maybe it could be a woodland or forest archetype. However, if your site is incredibly open, then maybe it could be something that reminds of meadow conditions and could be incredibly beautiful then. So this really, the structural analysis is a very first good start.
Okay.
And then once we get past that, we often look at seasonal events on sites, meaning are there any plants, either trees or perennials, existing already that when they all flower, they create a moment in your garden that knocks your socks off, that is just incredibly beautiful, emotionally very strong and resonate.
Right.
If we have beginnings of these seasonal themes or seasonal events, then in our designs, we often try to, as Thomas likes to say, turn up the volume and make them even stronger so that the planting looks dazzling at certain times of year. It's almost like an art installation.
You know, that's so important to say because, you know, I think when people ask me, and I don't have your expertise, but, you know, I've been gardening a long time and people will come to visit and they'll say, well, but how do I do this?
Mm-hmm.
And I say, I don't know, but I say one thing. I say, go inside your house and look out the window and see what you want to look out at 365 days a year, first of all, because most of us gardeners don't view the place from just outside. We look from inside, out most of all. But second, I always say, do you have any of those sort of ephemeral, those moments like you just described? And if so, and you love them, like maybe repeat them, yes, like you're saying.
Yes.
Bolster them, make them a signature, yeah?
It's such a great tool, and if anything, it's a wonderful excuse to go plant shopping.
Or divide, which is the harder work.
Exactly, or barter with your friends.
Yeah, divide, dig them up and divide them. Yeah, okay,
so we have that layer,
the moments. We have the sort of architectural, structural, then we have these moments.
Right. And then the last thing we really look at is how well does your garden or your landscape currently cover soil? And there, again, we don't mean the wood mulch unless it's temporary, but we look at ground covers. We look at not only ground covers in shade, let's say under deciduous trees, for example, but also ground covers in full sun conditions. because the more we have there in terms of plants covering soil very densely, the less weed pressure we usually experience because we're already covering soil with a desirable plant. So that is the last and more detailed piece that we analyzed to see how else we could add more green into that landscape to reduce maintenance and increase biodiversity and the functional qualities of a planting. So that often gardens have an extreme lack of ground covers. That is something that is quite common, and not only in American but also in European gardens, where many plantings are just chronically undervegetated, and that often leads to the maintenance elephant. That we spend so much time battling weeds because we provide the ideal conditions for them, bare soil.
So we might have said, "Oh, I love this particular lily," and we might have a bed with the lilies, but there's nothing else beneath it, or there's just mulch, right? Or
exactly,
we might have those taller kind of show-off plants, but they're just sort of there, and they don't have the underpinnings either structurally or again to provide that living mulch.
Yeah, that is so true. That green mulch layer is often the one that is missing, and many times clients they express concerns that if, for example, we added a ground cover to a bed of beautiful lilies, wouldn't these ground covers actually compete with some of the taller plants, even trees and shrubs? That concern, we actually hear that quite often. But when you actually zoom into the above and below ground morphological structure of plants, you will notice that they have different morphological expressions. Some plants have very delicate fibrous root systems that grow in maybe only the first 2 to 5 feet of the soil. Other plants, if soils are deep enough, can go down to 15, 20 feet.
Wow.
And because of this incredible diversity of morphologies, plants are able to share limited resources within different genera or species by occupying different horizons above and below ground. So they don't actually compete with one another. So I'm not saying that all plants are good companions to one another. Some are real bullies that would not pair well with lilies.
Yes.
But in general, it's possible to find just the right companions that will share resources and not be a threat to your most beautiful, beloved plants.
So now, it is okay, so we've analyzed these three dimensions, so to speak. And but then when you go to suggest a design to this client. Do all of the gardens, are they all kind of modern or are they all cottage? Can they fit into any, this theory of this layered design that's inspired by plant communities, can this, and that plants are the mulch and so forth, can this be in any style? No matter what I want it romantic, I want it old fashioned, I want it modern and sleek. Can it be anything?
Mm-hmm. This is a really, really good question. And the wonderful thing is that working with layers and designed plant communities in general is not a style at all. It is a method, or sometimes we even call it a technology, that is deeply rooted in science, that can really be applied to all kinds of design expressions, from very formal to very naturalistic and anything in between, to make sure that it matches the right level of wild versus neat, depending on your own preference or what is required, depending on the visibility of a planting area. So layered planting systems don't necessarily mean high biodiversity and complexity. They can sometimes be as simple as maybe 3 or 4 species, one on top of the other, and maybe some bulbs in between. They can also mean 35 to 40 different species in more complex planting.
Okay.
So,
Okay, so it's not a style. It's a technology. So we have maybe, 4 minutes or so, 5 minutes left. And most people listening today probably already have gardens. And so we just talked about like walking through a prospective client's garden. But when I walk through my own, I've got lots of stuff. What am I looking for? Can I retrofit some of the ideas of this system, of this technology, into an existing garden? What am I kind of looking for when I'm doing that?
Absolutely. So I think every existing garden can be massaged into the planting that you envision that resonates personally and creates just a wonderful outdoor space that enriches our lives. It sometimes helps breaking up the different tasks into individual achievable steps there. Sometimes a really good time to analyze your own garden is to wait until winter, when you can often see trees and shrubs more clearly, and some of the ground vegetation has died back just a little bit, to give you a little bit more clarity over the framework of the design. And that sometimes allows you to edit a little bit, you know, to either insert more trees if you would prefer a more sheltered, shaded landscape, or if you prefer a little bit more open space and room to see, and maybe put up a wonderful bird feeder and enjoy them in an open clearing on your property, then that is a really good time to edit away maybe some of the obstructions there. So that is something that could be done in the time of year when we tend to do a little less gardening, some editing. And then at other times of year, I think it's a wonderful exercise is to analyze your events, your seasonal themes in the garden, to see what you have blooming a certain time of year and how you could enhance these events strategically by placing either more of the same plant in there or more with a similar color to strengthen these themes even more. So by kind of breaking this big task up into smaller goals and actions, it often becomes a lot more clear and achievable to edit an existing garden. But by no means do you have to start over and start from scratch.
Oh, thank goodness, Claudia, because I'd be up the creek if I had to start over.
Sometimes it's as simple as adding maybe a little bit of ground cover under your taller perennials, your shrubs, and your trees. Maybe that's all your garden needs.
So in the last minute or two, you've worked for the noted wholesale plant producer North Creek Nurseries with their amazing plants. You're a real plant geek, I know. Are there any Claudia West signature plants that always appear in landscapes? I mean, assuming they're regionally appropriate. Do you have a favorite genera of plants or a favorite, you know, do you know what I mean?
This is probably the most difficult question to ask a plant nerd.
I'm obsessed with Aurelias. I'm an Aurelia nut, for instance, so that's what I'll confess. Yeah. So do you have any?
I absolutely adore sedges. I think that is a genus that currently I'm doing a lot of research on, a lot of experimentation. It has thousands of different species, and they're very few of them have been discovered for ornamental and functional horticulture. So I'm currently experimenting with adding them to both my rain gardens, to rooftop gardens, container gardens, meadows and meadow gardens, and all kinds of woodland landscapes. So I find that incredibly inspiring at the moment. But I'm sure that after this, there will be other plants that capture my attention.
So you're a carex lover,
Absolutely.
Okay.
They're adorable and so functional.
Oh, that's interesting. I was just walking along the perimeter of my property, the woodland edge, and I was noticing that nature has grown a lot of carex there.
Right.
And I was thinking, gosh, I wish I even knew what species they were. They were so beautiful and, you know, linear in a way, and but like what would I say? They were kind of curvaceous at the same time. You know, they had like movement almost to them, and the way they picked up the light, they were beautiful. And I thought, I should get to know these better. So funny you should say. Well, Claudia West, I'm so looking forward to our August visit. I'm going to give all the details with the transcript of this show. We'll do a book giveaway for planting, a copy of Planting in a Post-Wild World. And I'll talk to you soon again, I hope. I'm learning a lot. I keep rereading, dipping in again to the book. So thank you so much for it and for today.
Well, thank you again for having me. It was really a treat talking to you.
Good.
Thanks.
And it was nice talking to all of you, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. You can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or facebook.com/awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.